Welcome back, everybody, to your second favorite film podcast. I'm your host, Bradley, coming to you live from Vancouver, Canada, where today we are screening This Week in Movies, the weekly film podcast where we discuss the movies we watched over the past 7 days in a spoiler-free way, so you know what to watch and what to not. This week's show is about goblin kings, divorce, difficult parental relationships, murderous rabid monkeys, booby-trapped shotguns, and Thomas the Tank Engine. We are going to cover 3 new releases this week. We've got Is This Thing On?, Primate, and Dead Man's Wire. We're going to have a chat about award season darling Sentimental Value. We're going to throw back a few years to Bullet Train, and finally go right back to the 80s for David Bowie's Labyrinth. It's been a crazy week, and those are a weird 6 films to have watched in a week, but I'm going to give you my overall thoughts and rating for each film. I'll cover what popped, what didn't, and finally pass along a recommendation about whether you should watch it or not. If you wouldn't mind at this time putting away your cell phones, finishing up any conversations you might be having, and grab your popcorn because it's finally time to talk about some movies. First up, we have Is This Thing On?, directed by Bradley Cooper. Notable stars include Bradley Cooper, Will Arnett, and Laura Dern. Now, I went into this film, I looked at the slate of early releases, and we're in this weird window where a lot of these films were like released at a festival in 2025, so they're saying 2025 on Letterboxd, but I live in Canada, and it released in Canada in January of 2026, so this is when I can watch them, so I'm kind of hamstrung by that. Is This Thing On? Was the one film when I looked at the slate of movies that I thought, I'm gonna like that one for all of the reasons, like the concept of the film, the people in the film, I love Bradley Cooper as a director, I'm gonna have a good time, and boy oh boy am I here to report that this movie is awful. I walked into the cinema bright-eyed. Bradley Cooper was directing. He was starring. I also like him as an actor. Will Arnett, fellow Canadian, I'm in on him. Laura Dern. Everyone loves Laura Dern, divorce, comedy, this film is gonna rock, and it did not. It is tonally strange, it doesn't tackle any of the plot lines in a way that's satisfying, and the premise is cool, but it goes in the wrong direction. Those are my overall thoughts on this film. This film has a really cool concept. There are these two people, Will Arnett and Laura Dern, and we kind of start in media res with them divorced. And of course, I don't want to spoil anything on This Week in Movies. And as we go through the film, each of these people is dealing with that divorce. One of these people is dealing with it by looking backwards in their life. That's Laura Dern's character. And she's looking backwards to a time when she was a professional athlete and kind of hopping back into that world to deal with all the shit that happens when you're trying to figure out a divorce. It's a lot of emotional upheaval, and we're trying to figure that out. Will Arnett's character does the thing that's kind of advertised on the poster and in the trailer and kind of the whole premise of the film, decides to deal with this divorce by diving into something new, exploring new terrain, picking up a new skill, like all of us like learning how to knit during COVID. He meanders into a bar. The bar has a cover of $15, which I guess is New Yorkish. I don't know. Whatever. And then is able to get out of paying the $15 if he decides to do stand-up comedy at an open mic. Does that for a little bit. Decides he likes this and kind of explores this stand-up comedy as a way to deal with this divorce. Now, if that is what the movie was going to be, that's like the first couple of minutes. And if that's what the movie was going to be, I would have had a great time. Instead, the film kind of has these two characters constantly kind of interacting with each other and kind of finding situations with which they're going to be like put in together. And it becomes more of a will they, won't they. And I would have preferred this film if it was just a won't they. Like, they're like, I just want them to be won't they. And I want this to be about two adults going through an emotional upheaval in their life and then learning how to deal with that via these two different perspectives and approaches. That would have been a very interesting film and a very good use of all of the shit that makes up this film. Instead, at no point do I think anyone gives a shit about this divorce. At no point do I think anyone cares. There are some sequences with the kids. You know, these two people have kids, and it's always difficult for kids going through a divorce. And when the kids were on screen, kind of trying to figure it out, I was having the best time with this divorce plotline, because that's when I was like, oh, yeah, I get it from, like, the kids' point of view that this sucks, and it's, like, a big change in their life, and they're not really understanding it, and, like, that makes sense. Also, just, I was once a child, you were once a child, I'm sure we all kind of grew up either going through it ourselves or knowing someone who went through it, just some kind of, we're all friends of a friend who have, like, you know, gone through a big divorce and kind of understand what that's like for kids. So I was responding well to that. Even if the movie didn't take it super seriously, it kind of tried. Will Arnett, Laura Dern, any of their friends, anyone else, like, this divorce did not seem that crazy. It kind of just feels like, oh, no, they got divorced. That's where, oh, they're hanging out in the same room. Look at how great these divorce people can. Anyways, this movie sucks. I don't like it. I wish it was better. I really wish it was better. And there's a lot of people that do like it, right? I'm not here to hate movies that people like. I'm not here to yuck anybody's yum. There's a lot of people who like this movie. And if you like this movie, I'm really happy for you because I wish I did. It's very watchable. It's very well made, all of that. Like, if you like, this is not a movie that if you like it, you're liking it despite it being bad. I just think it's bad, and you probably just think it's good, and that's really great. I just couldn't handle anything about this movie. And then, like, the whole stand-up comedy plotline isn't funny, and that's fine because it's not about the comedy, it's about the divorce. He's not meant to be good at comedy, he's meant to be using it as a way to deal with the divorce, but since no one cares about dealing with the divorce, or at least the movie doesn't, then the stand-up comedy needs to be funny, and that's not very funny. There are some sequences in this film that are great, but I just think that this film does not land the plane, it doesn't take off, it encounters turbulence the whole way. None of it's offensive, like, it's very watchable. Like, the whole 2 hours I was sitting there, I was like, okay, this is a movie I'm watching. It kind of just flicked in front of my eyes. I left the theater and went, man, I didn't love really a single second of that. So I'm sorry if this thing on was like a favorite of yours. You went in and you're like, oh my God, I love that. I can't wait to listen to This Week in Movies to see if Bradley also liked it. I'm sorry to report that I did not. If I'm giving it a pop scale rating, I'm going to say it's stale. It's certainly not burnt. Like, I can see someone going into this movie and really enjoying it, right? Like, it's not poorly made. The performances are good. All the rest, like, it's all the plot of this film makes coherent sense. Like, you're not going to be lost in this film. Like, what happens is very coherent. And it's just not the plot I wanted to follow in this film. And that plot didn't have the tone I wanted in this film. So it's like, none of it came together for me. There were a few things that popped though. I actually only put down one, so I just lied to you. But I never said at the top of the podcast I'd be super honest. Okay, anyways. Bradley Cooper in this film. He directs this film. He also casts himself in a role. Awesome. You know, king shit happening there for Bradley Cooper. He plays a character colloquially known in this film as Balls. So Bradley Cooper is playing a character named Balls. And Balls is like, you know, he's meant to be not a muse, but like a foil. That's the right word. He's a foil to the Will Arnett character. They can kind of go through similar things, but because they have different dispositions, different backgrounds, different approaches, it can kind of end differently, et cetera, et cetera. So he plays like a struggling actor who's just kind of a hippie and going with the flow and getting high or whatever. And every time Bradley Cooper was on screen, I was having a blast. And so that's good. I think that's also the problem with the movie, is that the only time I was having a blast was when Bradley Cooper was on the screen. And since he's not the main character in the main plot line and, like, isn't overly, like, his character is important to the version of the movie they told, but not to the version of the movie I was hoping they would tell. Like, it just, what's also the problem with the film is that it's at its best when one of its, like, side characters is just kind of saying random shit and his name is Balls. So I don't know if this movie is very successful. What didn't pop? There were two, like, I don't think this movie is successful, but there are only two things that stood out to me as, like, particularly bad. First, it's a divorce film, which doesn't take the divorce seriously. I've mentioned that, but you either need to then make it a full comedy, right? A comedy never takes anything that seriously. That's what makes it a comedy, right? Like, I've watched Hot Fuzz. That's a comedy. There's a lot of people get, like, shot in the face in Hot Fuzz. Like, it has serious subject matter at points, but because it's a comedy, it doesn't take it. It's tonally cohesive. Whereas this film is about this divorce, and you're meant to really feel this divorce. Like, this divorce is meant to have, like, an emotional and psychological impact on the people in this world, and I just feel like it doesn't. So that's the first problem. The second thing, and this is a personal pet peeve, this was something that grated on me, and this is actually lucky that I was sitting in the theater, and I had already, because this happens in the last scene, so I was already sitting in the theater and already decided, you know, I'm giving this, like, 2 stars on Letterboxd. I didn't love it, but it's like it's not offensive. I didn't hate it, but this just didn't really work for me. And then out of the fucking clouds, like someone jumped off the moon and skydived into my skull at Mach speed. The song Under Pressure from Queen comes on at the end of this movie. Now, within this film alone, the song Under Pressure was really stupid and like just didn't work and whatever. Anyways, expect that. If you like Queen, it might be worth leaving 3 minutes before this movie ends. Separately from that, though, there's a film called After Sun that came out a couple of years ago. Paul Mescal got the Oscar nom for Best Actor for that film. And that film is incredible. That film is like a touchstone film for me. It's one of my favorites I've ever watched. I love After Sun. Not a happy film. Very, very fucking, very dour affair over at After Sun. But that song, Under Pressure, is played over the last couple of minutes of that film in a way, and my girlfriend will testify, if you want to ask her, she'll testify that when the song Under Pressure from Queen comes on the radio or just like in the car or if we're like, it just comes on at like the shopping mall, I will like get like physically weepy and I'll notice it right away. Like my brain has PTSD from After Sun. My brain will notice Under Pressure's playing. I'll immediately like freeze a little bit and be like, oh, I can't listen to this song. I just can't listen to this song. And I'll like actively seek to not listen to it because I know it's going to make me sad and like cry because of how successful it was deployed in After Sun. And so for this film, so close to After Sun, right? After Sun is obviously doesn't belong or, you know, Under Pressure doesn't belong to After Sun, but so soon after that film deployed it so successfully in the exact same way, the gall of this film to try that and try to get it to work on me just frankly pissed me off. I left the theater in a fucking huff because of the Under Pressure shit they did at the end. That's why Bradley Cooper's character was named Balls. It was named Balls after his fucking cojones for trying this Under Pressure shit at the end. So, not a fan of this film. Didn't really work for me. I can see why people are fans of it, though. I'm not going to recommend it. I usually try and find a carve out of people. But okay, I didn't like it, but like, who would I recommend this to? I just don't know if there is anyone that I'm aware of specifically, like any group of people that I'm recommending this to. Just take a look at the premise. Take a look at some Letterboxd reviews. You know, if you just want to go and watch Will Arnett and Laura Dern on the screen for 2 hours, like it's not offensively bad, but just didn't work for me at all. Next up, we have Primate, and this is where shit kicks into gear, everyone. This is where January begins. Last week, slow start. We had We Bury the Dead, fine movie, but didn't, like, do anything for me. Primate? Primate. It's January. It's a creature feature. It's a horror film. You know this shit is gonna be terrible, but you know that it's gonna be delicious. It's like going and getting like a Dairy Queen Blizzard at like 11 at night. You know it's bad for you. You know you shouldn't be doing that. And you know it's going to contribute to several health problems you're going to have. And yet, it's absolutely delicious. This is directed by Johannes Roberts. Its notable stars are zero people. Even looking through the Letterboxd cast list, I couldn't find anyone I really recognized. The lead actress in this, and the actress I think gives the best performance, and who is really good, I think really good, is Johnny Sequoia. She plays a character called Lucy, I believe. That's the kind of the, insofar as there is a main character, it's Lucy. And I want to call out Johnny Sequoia here, because this seems like kind of her first big movie role, right? She seems like a newer actress, and I thought she did really well in this film. And then Troy Katzer plays the dad of the girls in this film. And I couldn't tell you who he is. I just saw his face on Letterboxd, but I've seen him in something before. You know what I mean? Like, he's kind of like a that guy where I'm like, yeah, I've seen that guy in something. So there's no notable stars here, but you know, Troy Katzer might be the most. I just want to shout out Johnny Sequoia here. There's a few other okay performances in this film, but Johnny Sequoia was the best one for me. Here's my context for watching it. I opened my Cineplex app. Right, when I'm not at the Rio, I gotta go to Cineplex, okay? And then I opened it and thought, what's playing at the theaters? I want to go watch a movie. And then I saw Primate, because it was the only new movie playing in theaters. for the days I wanted to go. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to step outside my comfort zone. I want to let you in on a little secret. I don't normally watch too many horror movies. I'll watch the really popular ones. Like when the people come and they go, okay, this is a horror movie and it fucking rocks, I'm going to go watch it. So I'll see. I went to Get Out and, you know, I saw Weapons, like all these really popular horror movies. Then I'll watch all of the horror ones that are not horror. Like Sinners is like, if you buy a ticket, it says horror movie. That's not a horror movie. That's just a movie with vampires and it's like bloody and dark. But there's like there's no horror aspects, I would say. And so going to a horror movie is a bit of a step, right? If I go to the cinema like 60, 65 times in a year, I'm not going to very many horror movies. I want to save them for the other genres. But I wanted to step out of my comfort zone. I got a podcast to do. And January is renowned for having the shittiest horror movies to ever exist. And so I thought, okay, we're going to head to Primate. Surely this is going to be the worst experience of my life. So this film had everything working against it. It's a genre I don't typically like. Separately from that, even if I did like it, it's a genre I don't typically go to the cinema for. Right, I prefer my horror movies at home where I can be a little wuss about it and like cry and like go under my blanket and make a tea or whatever. And so this had everything going against it. And I want to start by saying, as my overall thoughts, this film is profoundly stupid and in so many ways is bad. It doesn't matter how much you like it. It's hard for me to objectively say this is a good movie. However, I had such a good time at the cinema, I don't really have any other choice. This film, despite it being profoundly stupid, knows exactly what it's trying to do and goes straight for it. And every time it's doing that, it's doing really well, and that is most of the film, which is really good because that's the part I liked. When this film was like, okay, there's a monkey and it's gonna kill some fucking people, I was having a good time. In my kind of instant review on TikTok and in YouTube Shorts and whatever, I said, this film answers the question, what if The Summer I Turned Pretty had a monkey that fucking killed everyone? And that's the energy that's going on here. This film begins with like a character setup, right? So it's like before the monkey kills everyone, you got to set up who they're killing. And it's like the weirdest, bitchiest, lamest fucking 2026 TikTok generation, The Summer I Turned Pretty, kissing booth type of people. It is like a caricature of a caricature of a caricature of a teenager who has friends. Like, it's crazy. And they spend like 20 minutes like setting each of these characters up, right? So you have the good guys and the bad guys. You know whose house you're staying at. You know who are the siblings, who are not, who are just the friends, who's just staying. None of that fucking matters. Okay, none of those relationships matter. None of it. At no point during this film did I find any of those relationships mattering really at all to what was going on. So the first 20 or 25 minutes was rather pointless. However, in this film, the monkey, Ben, gets rabies and then goes on a fucking murderous rampage where everyone tries to figure out, they're all kind of stuck in this house with Ben, how they're going to stop Ben from killing everybody. And once it starts doing that, it doesn't really let its foot off the gas. And I'm very appreciative because for that last 70 minutes of a 90-minute movie, I was having a great time. Trying to find a pop scale rating for Primate is very difficult because it could be anywhere from burnt to warm. And it just depends on your disposition to this kind of movie. I decided to land on bland. Because I think this movie is profoundly stupid and in a lot of areas did have me like rolling my eyes and being like, this is just not very good. Specifically anything that had to do with like the character setup at the beginning. I was not really enjoying that too much. And other than two of them being sisters and there being a dad to two of the sisters, which kind of is a maintained relationship, I thought everything else was unnecessary. However, because I had a good time, I would watch that again. So it's like, if I would happily just show up and watch it again, I guess I gotta say it's at least bland. But so I'm gonna say, depending on your disposition to this kind of film, it could be the first burnt I give. It could be really fucking bad. If this is not the kind of film you'd like, you'll probably really hate it. If this is the kind of film, like if someone said, hey, do you wanna go to the cinemas for 90 minutes and watch a rabid monkey kill a bunch of teenagers? If your answer to that is, you know what? Yeah, then this is probably bland, if not warm, for you. Here's what popped. Here's what popped out. And I wrote three things down. There were three things that stood out in this film that were actively great. All of the monkey killing sequences were great. And once again, that's like 70 minutes of this film. So the monkey killing is really good. I liked that Ben, as the monkey, gets better and better and more creative at killing everyone. Not in a way that's realistic to rabies or whatever, but in a way that is very pleasing to the eyeballs of me watching this film. It would have been lame if Ben just like killed everyone the same way for 70 minutes. The fact that he like evolves a little bit in his murdering style, I find to be really interesting and really fun, but not, I'm sure the veterinarian or something is being like, that's not how rabies works. But you know what? I'm not one of those people. I don't know what rabies does. So it's like, that's fine. I'm going to get over that. I liked that the good guys and the bad guys both kind of get shit on by this monkey. like this film doesn't try too hard to be like this is where the setup is. Like, these are the good guys. These are the bad guys. And the monkey's only going to kill the bad guys. And all of our good characters are like somehow going to live. There is kind of that. And like the characters I most wanted to live were like kind of the ones that got the least amount of shit from the monkey. However, I liked that the monkey just didn't care who was who. It wasn't like, oh, you've been my owner for however long. No. This monkey, there's people and there's a monkey and the monkey's going to kill the people. And it doesn't matter who the people are. So I enjoyed that. Separately, to give some credit here to Johannes Roberts, whoever you are, I'm here to give you a little bit of plaudits for your directing, not for the whole movie, but for part of it. I think there's some really funny sequences in this film. There are funny sequences where Ben especially has objects. There's a particular sequence with like Ben and the set of car keys that is just etched in my brain. I loved it so much. I was cackling. I was giggling. I was having a good time. And the suspense sequences are very well done. This is a film that could have so easily like over relied on jump scares or like really lame sequences of like people just like walking around and like, ah, a monkey or whatever. But there's a lot of really good suspense here in a way that didn't feel manipulative, but felt kind of fun and allowed you to like participate in the reveal that the person had just like walked into the murderous monkey or whatever. So I really enjoyed that. I thought it was well shot and the suspense sequences were great. What didn't pop? What stood out as actively bad in this film? I already talked about the character building almost entirely being unnecessary. And yeah, I stand by that. I think this first 20 minutes could have been 5 seconds. Like, these are the sisters, these are the friends, there's who's staying over, and this is their dad. I think that would have been enough. Separately from that, none of this would have happened for the whole film. I don't want to spoil anything too badly. It's really an unspoilable film. There's a murderous monkey and it kills people. Like, you can't really spoil this film. Anyways, none of this would have happened if anybody in this film had like a single functioning brain cell. Like, if all of these people like knocked their heads together and found one working brain cell, I think everyone would have come out completely unscathed. And so it's one of those films, it's less frustrating than the communication problem. Like, there's nothing more frustrating in a TV show specifically, but also in movies, when the plot wouldn't have happened if everyone just communicated properly. That, or at least communicated within their character, right? Like, there's a lot of films and TV shows like that. This is one of those ones where it's like, you just have to believe these are the dumbest motherfuckers that ever existed, and that's why this is all happening. But if you can just believe for 10 seconds that these are the dumbest motherfuckers existing, that's good. Once Ben's going around actively killing people, I think they actually do get pretty smart about how to try and figure this out. But that first kind of sequence, right, where they're like realizing the monkey's gonna kill them, I think if everyone just worked a little harder to figure out some solutions, we might not have had this problem. Here's my recommendation for Primate. If you think you would like this kind of film, like if that log line is appealing to you, like monkey people, monkey kills people, that part of the film is really well done and like really fun. And if you think you'd enjoy that, then yeah, go watch it. If anything about this film sounds like you would not like it, you'll probably hate it. And I think this is a miss for you. Now we can move on to Dead Man's Wire, another 2025 film, I guess, that released here in 2026. Anyways, it released today. I'm filming this podcast out the theater. I went to see Dead Man's Wire. I came home. I made some dinner. Now I'm talking into my microphone about Dead Man's Wire, directed by Gus Van Sant. Notable stars are Bill Skarsgård and Dacre Montgomery. A few other faces kicking about that I recognize, but those were the two like big build names. And honestly, the two names that I definitely knew from the actors in this film. This film is about a true story of a man who feels like, and probably, to be honest, has been kind of done in and kind of sucked in, chewed up and spit out by a mortgage company in Indianapolis. I want to say in the late 70s. I believe this film is set in 1977. And so it's the little guy. He's been fucked up by this awful, you know, one percenters mortgage company just leeching him. Kind of. The premise is that they sold him a property, right? So they loaned him the money to buy a property, and he was going to use that property to develop a shopping center. He found prospective buyers for the shopping center to like build on the land so he could then pay back his mortgage. Instead, the mortgage company, allegedly, but I'm assuming it's true, kind of paid off people to not put money down on the land. That way he couldn't pay his bills. He would be charged interest, so his loan would go up, and then he'd owe them more money, et cetera, et cetera. So this man feels like the bait and switch happened from this mortgage company. So he's really mad about it. How does he solve his woes? Well, he kidnaps the kid. He kidnaps the son of the CEO of this mortgage company and then creates the dead man's wire. So this whole film, you have him stuck to one end of the shotgun, the person he's kidnapped stuck to the other, and if any of them moves too much in one direction, the wire they're attached to will pull the trigger of the shotgun, killing the son of the mortgage broker. Once that happens, it's a film about the redemption. He's trying to use this kidnapping and the platform he gives him to be made whole by this mortgage company. I don't want to say anything else because this film is great. All right. It was January. It's in the movies. I think I'm seeing 4 movies this weekend or early next week. There's a lot of films coming out right now. I really don't want to have to talk about Mercy on this podcast, but that's 2 weeks from now. So you know what? We'll just get there when we get there. This movie is really great. This movie is really, really good. I would definitely say that I had a great time at the cinema watching this one. It's a really simple premise. It's based on a true story. I was vaguely aware of it even before I went to see the film. Really amazing characterization and performances. There are kind of our two main characters that are very well done. Both Bill Skarsgård and Dacre Montgomery are giving very great performances, and I really feel both their characters. The everything from the accents to the way they dress, the way they walk, the way they talk, all of the mannerisms. Bill Skarsgård genuinely comes out to play in this film. I wouldn't be surprised if at the end of 2026 I'm doing my favorite 2026 performances and I put Bill Skarsgård in that bunch. It's really incredible what he's doing in this movie. It doesn't overstay its welcome in the slightest. This is a 100-minute movie, like an hour 40. It's like a 100-minute movie that's just right. It's just long enough to kind of dig into everything and feel really good about where it's progressing. By the time it was over, like it ended 5 minutes before I would have hit my maximum time limit, which is the perfect time to end your movie. It's just like, just as I was starting to think, hey, I don't know how much longer this movie needs to go on for, it kind of just ended. And I was like, oh my God, you absolutely killed the pacing and the timing. That was just a very enjoyable 100 minutes at the cinema. It's great. It's really funny. It's really, really funny. I didn't find it as suspenseful as the film wanted me to find it. I think this film really wanted me to feel like, will he shoot the guy or won't he shoot the guy? So there's kind of two different points of tension I think the film wants you to deal with. One, is this going to happen accidentally, right? They're both tied to the shotgun. Is one of them going to move or do something accidentally to set the shotgun off? And that's going to cause a cascading series of events, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, once the film hits like 20 or 30 minutes and that doesn't happen, you're like, okay, right? You know, it's probably not going to happen now because that'd be weird for the movie. And then the other one is he just going to shoot the guy or not, right? And without saying whether he does or he doesn't, based on his characteristics and his mannerisms and everything, I don't think the movie's trying to trick you. I feel like where the movie went, I knew it was always going to go. And would have been surprised if it did anything different. And so in that sense, it wasn't very suspenseful. But that didn't take away from the film for me. If you go in knowing absolutely nothing about this, maybe you'll find it more suspenseful. I just felt like I could tell right away, based on the characters and their characterization, exactly how I thought this was going to end, which means everyone did a really good job characterizing the folks in the film. So I thought that was great. If I'm going on a pop scale rating, I'm saying this is warm. It's really, really good. There's nothing about it that really stands out as even particularly bad. I think maybe if I had to pick something, it's like there's a lot of police and FBI people involved, and some of those are just like jabroni actors who are like, I'm an FBI agent, and it's like, okay, cool. Like, they don't feel threatening in any way. I don't know. Like, I feel like the cops and the FBI agents and stuff in these kind of movies are always like a little bit lame. So there's like a few like lame police officers or whatever, but otherwise, yeah, I think this is a perfectly fine film. Really, really good watch. Here's what popped. The lead performances, already talked about them. They're amazing. The characterization and motivations, very, very good. I thought that this was a very relatable film. You know, this is about a person, you know, fighting the man, like a small lower class person finally getting a break in the world, only to have someone richer and more powerful snatch it away from him and like lure him into a trap. And I feel like from his point of view, he's very, very rightly upset, and it's a very relatable kind of upset. Like, you know, some of us listening to this podcast might be, you know, super wealthy or whatever, but a lot of us, and I grew up in like a comfortable middle class family, not wealthy but comfortable, so this isn't even my experience in the same way, but I'm sure most of us have been like ripped off before. Like, I don't have so much money that I don't notice when like Netflix goes from $8 a month to $27 a month, and I'm like, now I feel like I'm getting ripped off. Like, we've all had that experience of feeling ripped off before, and I think that that was a very relatable kind of core to this film that I really enjoyed. The only thing I put in my what didn't pop section, there's a few storylines that I just don't think we needed, but they didn't take away from it for me, right? So there's these news reporters who are reporting on the situation, the kidnapping that's happening, and they get their own little storyline, right? Where it's like, you get to track the journey of one of these new, and it's like, you know, it's only a couple minutes of the film. It's not trying to be like a 1A or 1B side plot or anything. It's just there, right? It's just like, instead of having nameless, faceless news reporters, we'll actually like give a couple of them a name and have them go on like a little bit of an arc. And it's very pleasant. I just don't think we needed it. I was never like moved by it or invested in any of those additional storylines. This film kind of has one storyline going on, and we're sitting with that storyline, and that's where I was interested. So yeah, those are the only things that stood out. When they were doing like the news reporter timelines, I was like, okay, I don't know if I need this in this film, but yeah, it wasn't even bad. It just stood out as not as good as the other stuff we were doing. But otherwise, yeah, this is a great flick. If you want to go to this is what I would say. If someone said, hey, you know, there's all these movies out this week. There's this, there's Primate, there's like Anaconda, whatever. I want to see a new movie, right? I want to go to the movies. What would you recommend? I'd recommend this, right? Assuming they've already seen, you know, Marty Supreme's been out for a couple weeks. Avatar's been out for a couple weeks. Assuming they've seen all the big ones. They're like, you know, I just want to go to the movies tomorrow. I want to take my partner, you know, go by myself, you know, take some friends, whatever. What do you think everyone would enjoy? I don't think anyone would not enjoy this film. I don't think it's going to be anyone's favorite. I don't think anyone's given it 5 stars on Letterboxd. I don't think anyone's given it like lower than 3, though. It's just like a fun, watchable, interesting movie that where everyone involved knew what they needed to do, did it really well, and I really enjoyed it. So yeah, I would recommend Dead Man's Wire for sure. Sentimental Value is up next, and now we are getting into the 2025 Oscar race. This was a rewatch for me, but let's do the top details. Directed by Joachim Trier, big film. Stellan Skarsgård just won at the Golden Globes. It's in the conversation. If you weren't aware of it before, you're certainly aware of it now. Its notable stars are Renate Reinsve, Stellan Skarsgård, and Elle Fanning. Those are kind of the three big ticket names attached to this film. I'm throwing out Inga Ibstadter Lilius here. She's my favorite performance in this film. I think she's exceptional. She wasn't like a big star when this film came out and wasn't like on the marketing material or anything in terms of someone you should know, but I think through the awards season is someone who's kind of gaining that attention for a performance I think is really good. So I wanted to include her in my little notable stars category. Here's my context for watching. I've already seen Sentimental Value because I go to the movies a lot, and I heard a lot about this film, and it was playing at Fifth Avenue, which is a theater that's really annoying to get to in Vancouver, but one that is really great when Cineplex puts a movie you want to see there. So happy to go to Fifth Avenue to see this. I vaguely knew about it at the time I went to see it, you know, went in completely blown away by it, had an excellent experience. I think this is a beautiful, beautiful film. Kind of hadn't thought much about it. This would have been the beginning of November, maybe, when I saw it the first time. And then my girlfriend, who watches fewer movies than me, but I think she either happily or has just kind of resigned herself to the fact that I'm going to go to a million movies for sure. So she might as well come to some of them, because that's where I'm going to be anyway. And so there's those movies, you know, Wuthering Heights comes out in 2 weeks, the F1 film. That wasn't even true about F1. She just ended up really liking it. But Wuthering Heights is coming out in a few weeks. There's a few films. There was Die My Love, you know, J-Law and Robert Pattinson that came out. And there's a few films where she'll note them on the calendar, be like, okay, that's one you can't see without me. That's one you can't see without me. But it's like one in every 10 films. Sentimental Value is one where it was just kind of on the calendar. She'd seen that it was playing. I'd kind of mentioned that it was playing at the Rio. Yeah, I love going to the Rio. And so she was like, hey, well, I've never seen Sentimental Value. You know, she paid attention to the Golden Globes, Stellan Skarsgård won an award, et cetera, et cetera. So it just kind of all worked out where it's like, I wanted to go to the movies. I think she knew that I was going to go to the movies and wanted to spend the time with me. She hadn't seen Sentimental Value and wanted to see it. I really wanted to rewatch it. And that's just kind of how we ended up watching Sentimental Value. So this was a second watch for me. For my overall thoughts, I don't have anything to say that can't be better said by someone else who really loves this movie. If you go to Letterboxd or you go anywhere and find someone who really, really loves this movie, read that review and then go watch this movie, because I think you'll have a better experience with that context. Or don't, and just believe it's a great movie, don't read anything about it, and just go in blind. That's fine. I really love this movie. I don't love this movie as much as the people at the top end love it. There's just something I can't quite either give to it or get out of it at the very, very kind of upper crust of this film that kind of withholds it from that like really perfect movie for me. But it's so close just underneath that. It's a beautifully tender and sensitive film. You get to go on this whole journey with this dad and these daughters, and you know, I don't even want to say much more about that because I really don't want to spoil this film if you don't know anything about it. It's a relationship movie about parents and about daughters and about trying to connect with your parents and how hard that can be sometimes and how hard these relationships can be and how the act and the attempt to reconcile these relationships is really difficult because you have all that built up resentment. And even if you're trying to move forward, it's hard not to look backwards. Or even if you're trying to like heal, you know, you still have scars that are never going to go away. And this film just explores all of that so beautifully that it's impossible not to just feel like, even if you don't walk out of this movie and go, oh, I like that. Even if you come out and go, I didn't like that movie, it's undeniable the craft of this film and the mission it was trying to accomplish were all very successful. And whether you liked it or not is just whether it landed for you or not, right? But there's not a single frame of this film I think I would change, right? And so it really works on me. It's really, really great. I put in my notes here that it's kind of like going through, I don't know how to say this, this film really takes care of you. It takes care of the audience in a way that I really loved. It's a film that has some, you know, not darker, you know, explicit subject matter, but it's not always a happy film, right? Like, it is a film about difficult relationships and whatnot. So it's not always a happy film. It's at points a very funny film, but not a very happy film. However, I wrote that it's kind of like going through and being guided through a gallery or a museum by an expert of like the collection you're going through, where sometimes the content that you're looking at or reading about in an art gallery or in a museum or anything like that can be difficult. It can be difficult subject matter, but the way it's staged, the way the information's presented, the way the person leading you through it is kind of talking about it and how passionate they are about it kind of creates a very comforting experience for you to absorb what's going on. And that's how I feel like this film is. Like, it just creates the perfect environment for you to absorb the story it's telling. And it just does such a good job with every aspect of it. Like, the performances are obviously great from everybody involved. I have my favorite, which is Ingo's performance, but they're all fantastic. The screenplay for the story is wonderful, but even the way there's just kind of a house. Any film that has a non-human person, like just an inanimate object or like a city, become a character, I always add as a credit to the film because it's very hard to do that. This film has like a house that becomes its own living and breathing character. Like, just by simply existing as a place where these people are kind of moving in and out, as a place with like a history, the way Joachim Trier just makes this film, or makes the something like the house in this film become an important character, is just so impressive. I know I'm rambling at this point now with my overall thoughts. It's a gorgeous, 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 beautiful, amazing movie. And I think I would recommend this for everyone. It's just so, so, so good. On the pop scale, I'm saying it's fresh with butter. I just can't quite... There's something about this film where I feel like 99% of it is accessible to everybody. And I'm really tapping into that. I feel like I got 95% of the first time. I would really recommend a second watch of this. If you have watched Sentimental Value, this is even better on a second watch for me, where I could really just settle into the mode of storytelling and pick up on everything I missed the first time. I found it just so good, that so much better the second time even than it was the first. So I got to 95% the first time. I got to like 98 or 99 this time. But I feel like in order to fully capture that 100%, you needed to have been one of the characters in this film. You needed to be the father, or be one of the daughters, or be the Elle Fanning character, and have had that kind of relationship. And I just haven't quite had those relationships in my life in the same way that I can fully like give myself to the film. It doesn't take anything away from it. I'm sure that fresh with butter is not even what this film deserves. It's just where I have to personally rate it. But this movie just rocks. There were a lot of things that popped in this film. The performances are the biggest one. They're amazing. The cinematography and the use of the house, I think, is just incredible. There's a fantastic climax here. Interestingly enough, not only do I find this fantastic climax, or this climax, to be, you know, extraordinary, and I really, really love the last 5 to 10 minutes of this film. It's all amazing, but it's a film with a great climax, a great ending. I also have an alternate ending in my head that I really want to see the cut of. I have a way to recut the ending of this film, and I really want, like, if I could go back in time and watch this film with, you know, Bradley's edit at the end, and then watch it with its current edit, I wonder how I'd feel differently about it. But it's a film with a fantastic climax, which I always like mentioning, because nothing feels better than getting to the end of the movie and feeling like the journey was worth it because of where it ended up. And yeah, really, really great last 5 or 10 minutes to this film. And then it's just a great exploration of a variety of different life experiences, right? Like, you know, movies and TV shows and books and everything, they're all stories, they're all modes of storytelling. They're all trying to get you to relate a little bit to something you've experienced in your life, or to get you to empathize or put yourself in the shoes of someone with an experience you haven't had before. And I just feel like this film does such an exquisite job of balancing so many different things. Like, I'm not a person with children, right? I work with a lot of kids, right? So I'm very familiar with children, but I don't have my own children. And yet, you know, Inga's character is a mother with a son. And, you know, there's some plot lines involving the son and, you know, some things the characters want him to do and whatnot. And even though I've never had that experience, I just felt so deeply rooted in her exploring that as a parent. So yeah, this film just does such a good job of making everything either relatable or empathetic. And I just think it's great. It's very nuanced, it's very subtle, but it's also like right in your face. And I don't know how to talk about this film, man. It's really, really great. I put literally nothing in my what didn't pop section. Like, there's nothing about this film that stands out as even remotely out of place or weird or bad or anything. I think this film is perfectly calibrated. And if it hits for you, it hits. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But I suspect it's going to hit for almost everybody. My recommendation on Sentimental Value, I wrote 1,000 times yes. This is a film worth watching. This is one of those films that's great because even if you don't like it, even if you go and you don't like it, which is, you know, going to happen when you watch films, you're not going to like all of them, you cannot deny the craft of this film. And so even if you don't like the movie, you'll still be able to walk out and go, man, I love the cinematography. I like that Stellan Skarsgård performance. Wasn't Elle Fanning great? Like, you can still, even if you don't like the movie at the end, you can still appreciate lots about it, which is a really good spot to be in if you're a film. So yeah, 1,000 times yes, I think people should watch Sentimental Value if you can find it. I would watch it in a cinema just kind of for the score and experiencing the silences in this film with like 200 people yesterday was incredible. That was really, really fun. So yeah, Sentimental Value, definitely worth watching. Two more films. Next up, we have Bullet Train. Now, we go in order in this podcast of newest release to oldest release, but this is not the order in which I watched them in. But Bullet Train, this was the first movie I watched this week, even though it was the second last on this podcast. 2022, directed by David Leitch. Notable stars, buckle your fucking horses, all right? You know, put your jabronis in a pile. Because we have Brad Pitt, Joey King, Aaron Taylor Johnson, Brian Tyree Henry, Michael Shannon, Bad Bunny, Hiroyuki Sanada, Sandra Bullock, and Logan Lerman. Those were just like the actors I remembered. That was off the cuff. That wasn't even looking at Letterboxd or anything. All right. That's a star-studded lineup. All right. That's a star-studded lineup of people that rock. Okay. So this film has a lot of people in it that I like. I watched Bullet Train because I was bored and I was laying in my bed and I had my iPad and I thought to myself, as I do often, it is time to watch a movie. So I opened up Netflix and I wanted something a little lighthearted. Just so it's a little fun. I didn't want to cry. I just wanted like something fun. I didn't want like a big action flick like John Wick. So I thought, okay, Bullet Train. Now, this ended up being an action flick, not dissimilar to John Wick. However, I had a good time with Bullet Train. I went in because I'd heard about Bullet Train, and the reputation I've heard is it's like a perfectly fine, not amazing, but not dreadful, like fun 2 hours on a train where all your favorite people are like beating each other up and going on a mission, and it's kind of like Agatha Christie, everyone's trapped on a train, and we gotta like, it's a bunch of different spies doing spy shit and whatever. And I was like, you know what? That sounds like close enough to what I'm looking for, but far enough away from what I'm trying to avoid to give it a go. This film is fucking nuts. This film is crazy. This film is, it's like problematic to talk about because I have no idea how to talk about this film. My overall thoughts are this, and I apologize if this makes no sense. This movie is simultaneously absolutely incredible and absolutely dreadful, and it oscillates on a literal second-by-second basis that I could never find my footing. At no point did I ever know whether this was the best movie I ever watched or whether I was having a terrible time. That is how quickly it oscillates from one feeling to another when you're watching it. Basically, there's a train. A bunch of different people have been giving individual missions to be on that train. They're all like spies, murderers, killers, those kinds of people. All of these different missions they have end up converging and coalescing while they're on this train. All right. And they don't really leave the train for the whole 2 hours. So that's kind of where we are, is this 2 hour sequence on this train with all these people trying to like beat each other up and kill each other. This film is, it doesn't take itself seriously. This is not like a serious, down-to-earth, gritty, whatever. This is a hilarious, over-the-top, completely fucking insane, colorful, flamboyant, eccentric action flick, right? So in that sense, I was having a really good time. This film also relies on a lot of bits and a lot of contrivances and a lot of weird shit that's happening and a lot of just like, What do we have to say and what do we have to do to get all these people in a room together? And so there's a lot of that really grates against you. I want to say on Letterboxd I rated this 2.5 stars, but that's because it was either five. Each sequence was either a 5 or a 1. It just kind of added up to 2.5 in the middle. On my pop scale rating, I put bland with butter. And I don't even know if I'm sticking by that. Like, it's bland in the sense that it's kind of right in the middle, but with butter because it is very over the top. It's very eccentric. It's very, very shiny and bright and very funny. Like, you can just laugh at it. It's in the vein of, Yeah, I guess I mentioned Hot Fuzz earlier. It's in the vein of Hot Fuzz, where it's like an action flick with a lot of action, but at no point does it ever feel like that serious. It's just a really weird movie in terms of how I feel about it. I haven't had that feeling in a long time. I just maybe never had that. Like, I just don't know how to talk about Bullet Train. It's just a movie that generates so many feelings. Overall, I say it's bland with butter. I liked it more than I didn't, but it's a wild oscillation of feelings. Like, this movie is pointless, right? Like, if this movie was never made, no one missed out, right? But also, if you stumble upon it and just watch it for 2 hours, you're going to have a good time. You might even feel enriched and enhanced. And those two things kind of being true at the same time is kind of blowing my mind a little bit. It's just hard to talk about on a podcast. Here's what popped. There are tons of hilarious performances. Everyone here is either on their A game or just hamming it the fuck up to the point where it's just like funny and weird. And so either all of your favorite people are genuinely giving good performances or giving bad performances in a way that are so funny that you kind of just enjoy them anyway. So that was great. Every character in this film, and there's like 200, have their own bit. And almost all the bits worked for me. The ones that didn't really grind it against me, everything Logan Lerman was doing, not really my cup of tea, you know, for this film. However, for most of the people, I was really enjoying their bits. A lot of people have their own individual thing going on. One of them is like obsessed with Thomas the Tank Engine and kind of uses the different characters of Thomas the Tank Engine to kind of, what would be the word here, psychologically profile people in a way that I think is really funny. Brad Pitt is playing this character where he's like, he's not retired, but he's like, he's just back in action for the first time in a while, and he's discovered like Buddha and like, or Buddhism or some kind of peaceful namaste kind of thing. So he like really doesn't want to use weapons or hurt anyone. He keeps encouraging everyone to like, you know, think about it and be positive and that's really funny. So that's great. I just want to say in general, the thing that popped out the most is Joey King. This is a star-studded film of people doing some amazing work. Like Brad Pitt, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, Brian Tyree Henry, Michael Shannon, Bad Bunny, Sandra Bullock, and Hiroyuki Sanada are all doing really good stuff. Okay, Hiroyuki Sanada has less to do than the rest of those people, but they're all doing great. And Joey King is my favorite performance in this film by far. She's so good that it really stood out to me. So I really love Joey King in this. If you want to watch it just for Joey King to be amazing, it's definitely worth it for that. There was a lot I could put here for the what didn't pop section. It didn't really feel fair to, because this movie knows what it is, and I don't want to hold it against the movie for just doing what it said it was going to do, right? That's not really fair. There were just like too many characters and storylines. I think if this film had been, I think if you cut out two of the storylines and made the film 15 minutes shorter, it would have been a better experience. It was the only thing that truly stood out as like really weird to me, where I was like, oh, I wish there was just like a few fewer characters here. But you could watch this film and come up with a list of 100. So don't take my one line list of what didn't pop and assume there's nothing else that might grind against you in this film. There's lots. It's just about who you are as a person, and that was the one thing that kind of grinded against me a bit. With regard to a recommendation, I'm going to have to say, if it's the kind of movie you want to watch, which is a recommendation you give for a lot of movies, if you want to sit down and watch 2 hours of a lot of your favorite people putting on really good or really funny or both performances and beating the shit out of each other in a train, and you're down for that, like a John Wick-esque kind of action adventure, but it's less gritty and more like superfluous, then I suppose that this film is for you. Hell yeah. If you want to watch a movie that makes any fucking sense, then maybe this one's not for you. And finally, we have Labyrinth, released in 1986. Throwback for this one. Directed by Jim Henson. Notable stars, David Bowie, of course, and a young Jennifer Connelly. What a fun night that was. My context for watching was, it was Bowie night at the Rio. The Rio was showing Labyrinth for its 40th anniversary and The Hunger. So back-to-back David Bowie films. I was only able to go to the first one of the Night Labyrinth, the one I'd prefer to see again anyway, because I couldn't stay out till 1 a.m. I'm currently enrolled in an 80-hour advanced first aid course for like the 2 millionth time. You got to recert it every 3 years. So it starts at 7 a.m. So I wasn't allowed to go watch movies late at night, or I would have watched The Hunger as well. Got my double dose of Bowie, but it's okay. I got to see David Bowie and his bulge in this. I want to say quickly, this is a bulge movie. All right. It's a perfectly PG movie. In fact, I would say it's probably for kids to some degree, and you can see David Bowie's entire package, which is interesting. Weird choice. Anyways, my overall thoughts on Labyrinth. If you're not familiar with this film, Jennifer Connelly plays a teenager who ends up losing her brother to goblins. The Goblin King, the King of the Goblins, played by David Bowie, are gonna do some kind of ritual, unclear, whatever, on this baby. And Jennifer Connelly needs to find her way through the labyrinth, the titular labyrinth, to get her brother back, to find him and rescue him before her parents come home and she gets in trouble for losing him to the goblins and the Goblin King. So that's kind of what's happening here. Although this film kind of feels like it's happening while you're on LSD, so it's hard to know exactly if that's what it's about. This is a really fun time capsule film, set, setting, actors, everything. It's very 80s, right? So it was nice to be teleported back into the 80s. Obviously lovely. It's probably been about 10 years now since David Bowie died. Lovely to go back and watch a David Bowie performance. It's just really, really good to be doing that. I found Labyrinth this time around, a film that I saw a bunch as a kid, right? So I was born in 95. So my mom kind of grew up in the 80s. Those would have been her kind of teenage and early adult years in the 80s. So very, very familiar with films like Labyrinth. And I found this to be a really good coming-of-age story this time around. It's the first time I've watched it as, like, an adult. I might have watched it, like, as my late teenage years, like, 18, 19, 20. Labyrinth is just a film you can always find on places, but I've never really sat down and watched it since I was a kid. It's a great coming-of-age story. It's silly, it's weird, it's interesting, it's delightful. It's just a fun... It's probably just around 90 minutes, like, just over 90 minutes, if I had to say. And it's just a really good, fun, charming watch. And I really appreciated it for that. It wasn't on the nose. Like, if you're a kid watching it and you just want to pick up on, like, ooh, goblins and ooh, creatures and ooh, a labyrinth. Whoa, David Bowie looks cool. And what a fun, magical world. You can kind of just, you can exist on that surface level with this and have a great time. If you want to dig deeper into, you know, the exploitation of the Goblin King and some of the people that are in the labyrinth, there's a whole plot line with one character and his friendship with Jennifer Connelly's character. You can really dig into that. You can dig into the camaraderie and the growing up. You can just really dig deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and pull whatever you want out of this film, which is a really, really nice thing to have in a kid's movie. Any film you can watch and return to as you grow up and find a new sense of purpose, sense of meaning, a new thing to pull out, something you hadn't noticed before, a new way of viewing it because you're older, you're more experienced, your brain can kind of hold more things, or your life experience has changed the way you view something, so it changes the way you view the film, et cetera, et cetera. Labyrinth has all of that possible within it, which is something I really, really loved. If I'm going to give it a pop scale rating, I'm going to say it's warm. I don't know if it's fresh or perfectly popped. It feels kind of undercooked in some areas of the film. And I don't know if that was like set, setting, budget, whatever, you know, screenplay. I couldn't tell you exactly what that was. It does feel like some parts of this were just a little bit underthought of, or like, I don't know what I'm saying. Undercooked is the best word. There's a few parts to this film where I would have liked a little more expansion, a little more exploration, a little more clarity. But otherwise, I think this film is warm. Jennifer Connelly's character is so funny. She starts as like a teenage girl who, you know, is mad that she has to babysit so her parents can go on a date. So she accidentally sacrifices him to the Goblin King or whatever. And then she's like, ah, fuck, I don't want to be in trouble. And like, I just got my brother kidnapped and that's scary. So she's trying to rescue her brother, and like, she's just such a funny character, and she's going through and making, she's just learning as she goes through. Like, she gets to the labyrinth and someone lies to her in the labyrinth. She's like, wait a second, you're a liar. You lied to me. And he's like, yeah, girl, this is the real world. People will lie to you all the time. And so I don't want to say much else about the film, just so you don't spoil it if you want to go watch it. But yeah, Jennifer Connelly's character is really, really funny. great use of like set and set design to tell the story. The creation of all the monsters, the creatures, the labyrinth, the kind of challenges, the trials, the tribulations was really, really great. What popped? The simplicity of the story combined with the vastness of the world, I thought was very, very well executed. This is a very simple story on its face, right? Where it's a girl loses brother to the goblins, has to rescue brother. To do that, there's a labyrinth in between point A and point B. She needs to go through its challenges, be kind of worthy of those challenges, and then kind of get to the end and rescue the brother. So very simple story on the surface, and the vastness of the world. There's different, you know, different characters and different areas and different monsters and different all kinds of stuff that allows you to kind of dig as deeply as you'd like to go. And I think that kind of juxtaposition between how simple the story could be, but the vastness of the world allowing you to explore the story more deeply, I thought was very, very good. And then the other thing that popped was that it was just fun to see a young Jennifer Connelly. It's always fun to go back into these films because, you know, Jennifer Connelly kind of came into my life as probably a 30-year-old, right? That's when I started watching movies she was like contemporarily in. And so seeing her as like, she's probably 16, 17 in this film, seeing her in one of her first films as just a, it's kind of watching the Titanic and seeing, you know, Kate and Leo when they were younger. It just, you get this sense of like, oh, this is really novel. This is really charming. This is really fun. So young Jennifer Connelly was great in this film. And it's really cool to know she's always been awesome. She's not newly awesome. She was great even as a teenager. So that was really, really good. What didn't pop? I couldn't quite put my head around this goblin world, and I get that it's made for kids, and to some degree you're meant to just be like, oh, okay, it's a goblin world that exists. I just couldn't tell how much of it was created by Jennifer Connelly's character, because it seems to me this world is all in her head. Like, this world came from her imagination. Like, she's imagined these goblins, she's imagined the Goblin King, she's imagined this labyrinth. Like, she's imagined it all, and that's how it came to exist, is through her imagination. But she just doesn't strike me as a character, based on the 10 minutes of characterization we get before she's in the labyrinth, that would, like, dream up, like, goblins. And, like, there's a place in this world called the Lake of Eternal Stench, right? That is just, like, a bunch of fart sounds and buttholes. And you're like, okay, like, maybe that's what a 15-year-old girl would imagine in their fantasy world. I just can't imagine. I just couldn't imagine this 15-year-old girl imagining that world. And that created some, you know, connection issues in my brain, some wiring issues that I couldn't quite get around. But otherwise, her having imagined it becomes, like, a really core part of the climax of this film in a way I really, really enjoyed. So I just, yeah, I don't know if they convinced me that this character kind of imagined that world, but once I got past it, I was able to just really enjoy the labyrinth and really enjoy the film. As a recommendation, I would say, yeah, it's a great time. Like, if you're looking for like a nostalgic, easy to watch 80s kids film, then this one's great. If you have kids, don't sleep on Labyrinth. Like, I think this would be a great one to show them. I'm definitely putting this on my list. I run movie nights for kids during the summer each year. Once a week, we get about 150 kids around, and we do these like outdoor movie parties for them. And so I'm definitely putting Labyrinth on the list of films kind of available for that. I think it was really, really fun to watch. I had a good time. But yeah, I think if you're kind of looking at Labyrinth and any part of it sounds enjoyable to you, or I would recommend it as a rewatch. Like, I haven't revisited in a while, and I had a great time revisiting. I got it at a David Bowie night at the Rio, so this one was probably full, like 300-350 people. But if you can catch it anywhere, it's a really, really good watch. I think though that is going to be it for this week in film. We had 6 movies this week. It was a bigger week because we got delayed because of the Golden Globes, but that's okay. Before I go though, don't forget to follow me on Letterboxd at Van Bradley. If you'd like to email the show, feel free to send your takes right on over to vanbradleyonfilm@gmail.com. This podcast would be a lot more fun if you also emailed me what you watched this week. That's kind of the point of doing it. It's like a podcast film journal. Please be sure to leave this podcast a rating or review wherever you're listening to it. Perhaps you could even subscribe to it if you're having a good time. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I'll see you next week at the cinema.